Take a seat. And thank you so much for joining us today for our newest Children's Literary Salon. I am your host of the day, Betsy Bird, who has a new picture book out coming in April. Yay! Shameless self-promotion. So if you have not been to a Children's Literary Salon before, allow me to show you the things you should pay attention to. Outside this room is an ARC cart, a galley cart full of delightful, delicious books that I would like for you to take home and own forever, because I don't want to wheel them back upstairs. So if you would like free books, please take them off the cart. Do not put any of your books on the cart. It defeats the purpose. There's also a sign-up sheet out there if you would like to be on our mailing list to hear about other future salons and what we have coming up, so please do not hesitate to put your name and email address there. And in case you are curious as to what these future events I allude to are, here are the next three that we have on the roster. Then we take the summer off, and then we begin again in September. So, on March 2nd at 2 o'clock in the Burger Forum, not this room, upstairs, there's going to be a panel on diversity and the state of the children's book. Very, very timely in the wake of the Newbery and the Caldecott announcement recently. Zeta Elliott, Sophia Quintero, and Connie Sue, and perhaps even a super secret guest, will be here to discuss the issues surrounding diversity in 21st century books for youth. So be sure to come and check that out. There's been a change of plans for the April Salon. Before, it was the first Saturday in April. No longer true, because apparently, woe is me, I'm going to Barcelona. So, instead, yes, too bad, tear. It will now be on Saturday, March 23rd at noon, which is insane. In this room, we're going to have a panel on the Alternative Children's Library. It is a discussion highlighting librarians who work in alternative children's library spaces. So we will have public services librarian Leah High from the Nolan and Watson Libraries of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Did you know they have a children's room? They do, for their library. There will be Allie Bruce of the Bank Street College of Education. There'll be Ayanna Coleman of the Children's Book Council. And there will also be, I believe, Jennifer K. Hanley-Leonard of the New York Society Library. So keep an eye out for that. And finally, on Saturday, March 4th, in the Children's Center, we are going to have a panel on, well, not even a panel, it's a little discussion on the Reluctant Reader 21st Century Techniques. We're going to have author Sue Stoffacher, who does, amongst other things, she's got a fantastic series called Donut Head, which you should definitely check out if you get a chance, but she also does the Wireman comic series. And there's going to be local reading specialist Andrew Hendricks. He's going to be there as well, and they're going to have a conversation about that sort of stuff. You will note today I have placed a website up. This is actually by Monica Eniger. It's actually a Tumblr, where she is keeping track of instances where you can find people who have called middle grade or children's books YA. There's some really good instances right here. So I'm just going to have it up in the background because I like to look at it. But in case you are interested in the website itself, the address is kidnotyabook.tumblr.com. But today, we have four fantastic panelists who will be joining us. So I'm going to right now invite them onto the stage. Come on up, guys. Have a seat. And then I will introduce you one by one so people know exactly who you are. Come on, don't be shy. It's fine. Yes. Oh, can I explain the penguin?
Well, Adam has to go ahead.
I can? Okay. I should know that when we decided to do this panel, we had some people from Random House and some people from Penguin. Since we organized this panel, Random House and Penguin have become one. So this is the Random Penguin. So it's now the unofficial mascot of the panel today.
And it's Adam.
Yes.
I'm the Random Penguin.
Yes, Adam's the Random Penguin. Yes. Yeah. Are you guys Random?
Definitely Random.
Okay.
You're not
going to
vote on.
And your mics are already on, so just blow it in mind. Yeah. FYI. All right. So I'm going to do this not in the order. Well, I should probably do it in the order you're actually sitting in, because otherwise it gets very, very confusing. So on my immediate right, now, Rebecca Stead hardly needs an introduction. I'm going to give her one anyway. Rebecca is a New York City native. Fun fact, she worked as a public defender for quite some time. She also wrote what she calls in caps very serious stories before she wrote children's books. And on her site, she actually says, one day my then four-year-old son, Bo Fabulous, accidentally pushed my laptop off the dining room table and the very serious stories were gone. Poof. Her bad luck was our good luck, because after that she started writing for kids. First Light, which you can see on the table there, was her first book, which is a truly original work of speculative science fiction for kids. Her second book was a little something you may have heard of called When You Reach Me, which won a Newbery Award, well done there. And her third and most recent title was Liar and Spy, a book so good that it has cemented her as one of our top middle grade authors working today. Very well done. To her immediate right is Adam Gidwitz, local school teacher, don't you know, who set out to write a book for kids, and he didn't go the normal route, which is why we love him. He found a complete collection of Grimm's fairy tales and discovered that when you get right down to it, fairy tales are gross, scary, frightening, and I believe he calls them awesome. And there's a reason people have loved them for as many centuries as they have. His first book was A Tale Dark and Grim, which was called by fairy tale scholar himself, Jack Zipes, quote, a profound understanding of the Grimm's tales, and he cleverly weaves different tales with an imaginative thread so that they form a grand narrative that has a critical utopian vision, a realm ruled by wise and responsible children.
I have no idea what Dr. Zipes is talking about.
Yeah, I know. It's awesome, though. Go with it, man. Go with it. So, yes. And if we want to talk about wise and responsible children, to his immediate right is Jeannie Birdsall, who actually she was the number one when I announced this panel. I had more people asking, will you ask Miss Birdsall when her next book is going to be done, please? And I had seven people ask me this on different occasions.
Seven?
Seven.
That's really not very
thank you, Jeannie.
She's used to much more.
Exactly. Yes, I'm sorry. I'll have everybody ask you after this. Okay, we'll make you
sure. Is that really on?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's on. Don't worry about it. Ms. Birdsall has held a variety of jobs over the years. She's a very accomplished photographer with her art located in such places as the Smithsonian, the Philadelphia Art Museum. Perhaps you've heard of them. But her middle grade novel, The Penderecks, was a National Book Award winner, and she has two sequels, and it is not an overstatement to say that she is not merely beloved by her fans, but seen as a kind of children's book writing god.
Yes.
Speaking of children's writing gods, Nate, or M.D. Wilson, is our last author right over there, and he's the only man I know who can get away with writing life-altering children's fiction from Idaho. Well played, sir. Yes. You're M.D. Wilson.
And now
that.
Matthew Kirby.
Exactly. And now Matthew Kirby, which I'm very pleased to say is now also from Idaho. What do you think about true, honest-to-God American fantasy for kids? We talk about Nate. He can write standalone tales rife with veiled references or not so veiled to Odysseus, like in Leapike Ridge, and then turn around with a series that puts the epic in epic fantasy with this trilogy with the 100 Cupboards books. Most recently, he's been writing the Ashton Burial series, which is fast-paced, fun, and weaves real-life, very real, weird history in with slam-bang action-packed fantasy. So thank you so much for joining us, and give a hand for our panelists today.
But I'm a children's librarian, so I don't need one. So I'm going to start us off, and I'm going to ask you guys, because our panel today is discussing the fact that middle grade authors more often than not in the realm of popular culture, because YA is so hot right now. Pop culture wants to call all middle grade YA, and this is rather annoying. So I'm going to ask you guys, what distinguishes middle grade from YA? And why is it important that we keep a boundary between the two at all? Any thoughts on the matter?
I have a thought. I think what distinguishes, what should distinguish YA from middle grade is the readers, and there's definitely a lot of overlap between the two, which is good, but in terms of the focus of the readers, and I think that the main difference between the two is what Philip Pullman called dust in the Golden Compass series, right? And, at some point in a kid's life, the dust descends, and they become sort of a different person, and the dust is, part self-consciousness and part hormones and part who knows what else it is. But the dust descends, and they become YA readers. That's my opinion.
Yeah. Amen.
Thank you. I was in the shower this morning. Just damn, got it.
I would say voice is always, for me, is the most distinguishing thing. I think to be writing for that age group, there needs to be someone in the book who's providing a measure of safety and comfort. And I've been thinking about the four of us. It's a very wide range here. Adam, of course, literally has the authorial voice busting out of the fourth wall and saying, okay, this is going to be scary, in a very funny, charming way that works. By the way, I love it when you do it. And there is somebody other really famous. I don't like when he does it. You do it very, very well. So, and what he does is he defines right away for the child what this is going to be scary. It isn't, but he does it in such a charming way that you know it's not going to be that awful. It's really a perfect balance. Rebecca is at the other end, that she works in first person. And at first I thought, how is she going to give comfort? And then I realized that you have, in both your books, you have adults that the children trust within the book. And so then I, as the child reader, know that it's not going to be awful. It's going to be okay. You produce comfort. Because usually I think that middle grade, the classic kind of way is more like what you and I do, which is the third person.
We are classic.
And we are classic. No, but the author himself, not to go as far as Adam does, but to produce that level of comfort, I am taking care of you, and you do it in this really fascinating way. But we're all doing it. And I think that's, for me, the key thing that a child who is 10 or 11 can pick up a middle grade book and should be able to, and know that they're not going to be faced with something too awful for them to deal with. That's what I think.
I think also, at least...
That you're frowning.
No, I'm saying it's so beautiful.
Oh.
That's what a frown means. For at least when you reach me, there's also the retrospective aspect, you know, where C.S. Lewis does this in the Narnia Chronicles, too, where you have a little moment of tension and suddenly you break, mm-hmm. and he does sort of an Adam thing of where the author steps in and comments, but he'll say, years later when Lucy looked back on this event.
Yes.
So it's like they don't, like, there's a little bit of security.
Right.
And when you reach me, it's the same kind of thing. There's lots of weirdness and tragedy, but there's this retrospective of having lived through it,
right,
and now I'm communicating what happened. But there is that security of safe passage, guaranteed safe passage to get through. I don't know that I actually do it at all.
I think you do, because I trust you.
Leapak, yes. I think more Ashdown's like, where do I provide security? Do I need more security?
No, I don't think you do, because there are good adults there. There's always someone to take care of, and you're also there. I'm never worried that you're going to pull something on me I can't handle.
My mom is.
Part of the job of calling it middle grade, and part of the reason that labels help us ever, is that because it's not always guaranteed, and hopefully if you're calling it middle grade and the librarians are saying this is middle grade for a middle grade reader, that's because the child will be taken care of in a way that a YA reader will not. Mm-hmm. So usually labels are not so helpful, but one of the ways they are very helpful is that even if it's not obvious from the narrative strategy or whatever that you're going to be taking care of the kids, you will be, because it's middle grade, that's what we do.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, right now we're in an era where what's hot is YA, you know, Twilight and Hunger Games, and it sort of finally permeated the public consciousness to the point where we're now seeing many more YA books being turned into films. We're seeing a couple children's books, but they're far more rare. It's mostly YA. Do you think, or do you worry, that the mainstream culture's sort of discovery, quote-unquote, of YA has caused some middle grade kids to sort of rush past the middle grade books into the YA books instead? I think, Rebecca, you mentioned that your fifth grade sons were reading Hunger Games in their class.
Well, no, not
okay, not in class, okay.
Not with the teacher.
Okay.
But yeah, that is something that I think about, which is, I guess, you know, is sort of a separate question from whether our books are called YA, is what are middle grade kids reading? You know, and to me that's an interesting question, because I think that kids who are 11 and 10 and 12 there's a lot of pressure now to be kind of like a teenager at that age. And I do think that that sometimes can include what you read, especially when, you know, the whole world, I mean, The Hunger Games was sort of a phenomenon, obviously, and there was, the films were, you know, the film was coming out, and, I mean, you couldn't keep really any fifth grader from that book a couple, last year, I would say. And it was really, really hard. And I wasn't trying. I wasn't, like, wresting the book from my child. But, you know, it takes a while to read those three books. So I was sort of having the thought, oh, well, you know, I wish he were reading these other books this year. But, you know, without worrying about it too much, I think in general, there may be a pressure for kids to jump to YA when they're 10 and 11. And I don't know then when they will... We'll read our books. No, we'll read middle grade. You know, which I think is just such a rich, rich world of books. Just, you know, so I mean, and I'm not talking about our books specifically, but what those books did for us, for me as a kid, you know, was present this kind of nuanced, complex, interesting. You know, much like really interesting. Books that were about real life and about the internal experiences of other people, which was really eye-opening to me. And, you know, it was a place where I, like, learned and explored and learned things about myself. And I think it is a different reading experience from YA reading. So I did email you that question, Betsy. Yes. That is why.
I mean, if I actually thought the kids were jumping to YA and so then they weren't reading our books, that would be pretty scary. But I'm guessing that it's a reader is a reader and they're probably reading both.
Maybe.
Well, that's what my hope. But I guess, to me, I think a child reader is smart enough to know that when they're reading something like Hunger Games, it is a YA book. And so they know they're doing something a little scarier. What I feel like my job is saying, when you read my book, I'm writing for your age, and I'm telling you that this is the way I think the world should be. This is how I think you should be safe. And that's the message I want to get. And if they are willing to go explore something else, as long as they can tell the difference. And that's back to Betsy's question about this conflation of the two. If the children don't know the difference between our books and Hunger Games, if they think they're all smashed together in the same category, then we've done them a huge disservice. That's what I worry about the most.
I disagree, but I could be wrong. So I'm going to say what I think, and then I want you to tell me why I'm wrong.
Okay.
So I think that that in the case of something like Hunger Games, in a lot of these cases, the distinction between middle grade and YA is I'm putting out the lights. Did you see that? That's how wrong I am. They were like, shut it down. Stop him from continuing. Hunger Games is YA because of, like, the brutal and relentless violence. Which is something that many middle grade kids, and middle grade obviously has distinctions within it too, but certainly fifth graders and certainly sixth graders are, you know, have seen much worse very regularly. What it doesn't have, I think, is that thing that, I don't know, so I was reading, recently Jep Who Defies the Stars. You guys read that, Catherine March? I think is wonderful. I think she does some amazing things. But in the first section of the book, there's an implication that a giant has sexual relations, has sex with a dwarf. And then a little later in the section, there is very strong implication that the court jester, who's a regular size, I don't know how you say it, person, rapes a dwarf. And then those are things that are really upset. I mean, they upset me, right? And they are really destabilizing to a little kid.
Yeah.
the violence in Hunger Games, I think, is something that they are inured to, except, you know, maybe at the very end, you know, at the end of the third book, but we're used to the end, the third book in every trilogy is always like, or the last book in every trilogy is always really upsetting. I think that, right, or in any, you know, in any series, right, somebody has to die. Yeah. Why do you do that? So I think that with Hunger Games and, you know, Harry Potter, a lot of teenagers read that, a lot of kids went up to Hunger Games, and I think that was okay. So I think that, I'm not sure, I don't know exactly what I'm saying, except that the distinctions are not so clear, and especially something like Hunger Games, sixth graders, even fifth graders can read it without a lot of worry. Some will put it down, rightfully, and some will enjoy it.
So was your point that Jeff who Find the Stars
is YA?
And shouldn't be read by middle graders.
Yeah, I would never put it in the hand of a middle grade of a kid because that
very middle grade.
I know, and I mean, I was sort of like, whoa, what am I reading? And I mean, she does an amazing job with the book, but it's hard. I mean, it's not something I would want to put in their hands.
Why would I think you were wrong?
Well, because I'm not sure that Hunger Games is quite the same kind of category.
I don't read anyway. This is one of the problems, so I'm just talking, you know, when I talk about YA, so, all right, so yeah. Why don't you?
On the Hunger Games point, the thing to me about Hunger Games that makes it YA is less the violence and more the deep ethical problems that are not actually resolved or answered, and are, I think, frequently are even disguised.
Such as?
So the loose sort of like, yeah, it's self-defense. Like, you know, there's this loose, like, she has to do this. It's like, well, but she's in there with other innocents. And when it's killer to be killed with other innocents, isn't it better to be killed than to, like...
Or there's, that should be dangerous.
There's a lot of discussion, like, is, like, what is going on, like, here? Is she a hero or an anti-hero? What's, like, what's going on? And there's a fair amount of complexity to that, that kids at a younger age just going to barge through to the action.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just go, 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 go. Mm-hmm. And especially when actually, for me, at the end, I think really a revolution is caused by a suicide pact. Like, this is how we, this is not, this, you have to actually tell the truth about how political movements start, and you have to tell the truth about, you know, how these things move. And she takes on much, much bigger issues like that that you're trying to explain, but it is, I think honestly, it reads like middle grade.
Right.
It goes through like middle grade, but it hits all these big things that are just left hanging.
And you think for YA they're addressed, or they're just not really addressed?
I don't think she addresses it. I think there's, basically, I think it's, man, it's a page turner. She knows how to do this. She knows how to put these things together. It's understandable why those books just went, like they took off. But I think there's sort of a walnut shell game where massive issues were opened up, and then commercial viability kicks in. Mm-hmm. And you move the walnut shell quickly, and we're not actually talking about why these two kids just formed a suicide pact. At the end, you just kind of just leave that there casually. And that has, I mean, same thing, 10, 11 years old, how do you get what you want? How do you beat the man? How do you beat a suicide pact? And so it's set up there as a solution, but it's no solution at all. It's just, it's more despair. And as far as middle grade goes, the distinction, at least in pop culture, as Betsy referenced, it's just all YA. So when I'm talking to consumers, if I'm, you know, sitting in a Costco doing a sign-in somewhere, then how am I processed? It's like, it's not teen, it's not picture book, it's YA. Everything's, and for them it makes sense, it's young adult, so it's just
young
thrown out there.
But
the problem is that you have these kids who believe that YA is reading level, like the ability to read those words means that you are now a YA reader, mm-hmm. and that middle grade is written to little kids who don't have the same vocabulary and don't have the same reading level, and so everything gets a little bit dumbed down, so they're resistant when they misunderstand the divide. They're resistant because they think that middle grade is less mature, sophisticated reading level, but YA is for those of us who can read well, as opposed to bigger issues, the dust has come, you know, like the bigger questions they're already asking that you need to talk about and answer, because they're already asking them. They're at that point in their in their lives.
This is interesting because you're bringing up, in a way, you're bringing up leveling and how leveling is affecting kids' interpretation of what a book is appropriate for me. It's the level, it's not the content.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're a teacher, you've had to deal with the leveling, I assume, not in your school, but you've at least seen the kids that have had to do the leveling. Point.
Yeah. It's always an issue when the kid says I'm a green or I'm a yellow, you know, and that's, you know, defining.
I can't read D. I'm only on C. Yeah.
Right. And I find actually I've been going a lot to Texas where it's really big to do AR. If you guys know what that is, advanced reading, where they get points for what they've read if they take a test on it afterwards. Yeah, and then and each book is worth a different amount of points.
That's so painful.
So Moby, yeah, you have points. Moby is worth 100, I'm worth like 7. And the kids will ask, they'll be like, is your book AR? And I'll be like, oh yeah. And they'll be like, how many points? I'll be like, 7. They'll be like, not interested. I don't have time for that. I gotta get a 30-day hanger under my belt at the pizza party.
Yeah.
I have no idea what they're talking about.
Yes.
I also, my son, one of my kids is in 6th grade, and they have to read 40 books this year, and any book over 400 pages counts as 2 for some of the kids, depending on who your humanities teacher is. And
poorly edited books are getting.
So yeah, they're reading.
What? Was that loud enough, Betsy? Would you say that?
Poorly edited books are getting more reads. That's what I said.
There's one definition I've heard, and unfortunately, I don't know where I heard this, and I wish I could credit it. I don't know who this. But the definition is that picture books are for kids to teach them what the world is like. Middle grade teaches kids, or shows kids, the world is unfair. And then YA is teaching kids who, or showing kids like who you are. They're about self-discovery. Would you agree with that?
No.
Are you fooling? I'm glad you guys said no, because I was going to say something much ruder than that. Go ahead, somebody.
I feel like voting for it just because that sounds wonderful.
It's just very reductive, right?
Yeah,
our books do. I mean,
it just simplifies you down.
Yeah, and I certainly hope that my books talk about like who we are and the world is not fair. Is in all sorts of.
This is not my agenda.
Right.
Well, it is, and you know, it's in YA too. I mean, I think. Yeah, right?
I mean, different books do different things, you know.
You should hope.
Yeah.
Otherwise, what are we all doing here?
I mean, right. So, I mean, I think that, you know, we could probably talk about what we think about when we're writing our books, you know, and it wouldn't all be the same. No, Jeannie? You're saying no.
I don't want to do that.
I'm not saying we should. I'm not saying we should. I'm just saying we would say 4 different things, I think. And for me, when I was reading middle grade books as a kid, I was after kind of, you know, truth and internal experience, you know. That was what I was after. I definitely was not trying to learn that the world is an unfair place.
Now the word truth has come up twice, you said it too, and that to me is part of what the goal of middle grade writers, the ones really working, I think, are to tell emotional truths.
Yep.
And what you were talking about it in terms of Hunger Games, of things not being true. And I think that that's part of, but it that we tell emotional truths. You talked a lot yesterday on the panel about getting inside the children and emotionally, it had to be an emotional thing, and that's what I tried to do too. And YA can get away with a lot of that sort of vagueness of character stuff, and she says who doesn't read any, I don't think middle grade can. I think that's part. And for going back to that crazy, as Adam said, reductive definition, what I think middle grade is for that period of time to help kids transition from the period where they have been identified, their major identity as being part of their family, as being a family member, but they haven't yet gotten to, the dust hasn't settled, so they haven't yet become part of the peer group. There's this lovely period of time where they're just learning how to be individuals and the whole world is open to them. And that's what I think our goal is. And yes, of course, we're all different, but I think that's what we're hitting on emotionally. I mean, you guys do it more as, you know, out there adventure, and we do it as more
internal motion thing because it's gender specific. How people were, no, that was a joke.
I knew.
You're laughing. Beth is looking at me like.
Well, I just—it's funny because I read these Paris Review interviews, and I was actually just trying to think. I just read that.
No.
Yeah. Who said that?
That would be.
I think Edna O'Brien said, "Oh, well, women write about this and this, and men write about that."
About the heart.
But I was
that's what it was. So I was thinking, oh, she's saying what Edna O'Brien said.
I think we all do both. There's a lot of heart in your guys. A lot of heart.
And
the relationships, the brother-sister relationships.
And I also think moral complexity is a big. I think that is, you know, if you look, if you talk to, I once wrote this little article for Time Out New York Kids. And it was about tweens, which is now a word that I don't like to use. So I interviewed, it's not a good word, I interviewed Michael Thompson and all these psychologists who, you know, different people and marketers, and it was really interesting, and it was very eye-opening. And one thing that I learned, well, A, just how much more pressure there is, I already sort of said this, on kids to act as if they're older than they are. And they're basically being marketed to that way, and that's a huge, it turns out, way in which we identify ourselves. It's like what we see, you know, on television and in movies, and because of marketing budgets and the way that people are now focusing on these kids who are preteens, there's a whole lot of information coming at them, telling them that they are, in fact, teenagers, or should be, more or less. So that's why I think sometimes kids do want to walk around with a YA-looking book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, you know, one thing maybe we think about with covers, is you don't want a book that looks too young if you want a middle grader to read it.
I'm just going to jump in real quick and say, the rise of the e-book with kids is mostly because they can now read the stuff that
they want.
Would tease them about.
Right. Do you think?
Because, yeah.
I heard that.
That's a good study. And that,
really?
That is why they like e-books. If they're reading at a different level or they can have an ebook, no kid makes fun.
And nobody knows. And I heard that romance sells very well in ebooks for the same reason.
It's actually because the fifth graders are reading 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah. Which is awesome.
Which is true.
But the second thing I learned in interviewing these people is that this is a time where, I mean, kids' brains are just, I mean, unfolding really rapidly, and there is sort of, I mean, not to romanticize it, really, but there's this sort of golden moment, you know, where they are so hungry and curious and intellectually able, and they want to be asking big questions, and they want to be, you know, juggling puzzles in their heads and learning these huge casts of characters and you know, sucking down these worlds, you know. And so, you know, I just sort of feel like, let's give that to them.
I think that's absolutely true, and I'll tell you what she told me the first time I met her, I think it was in 2008, which was that she writes middle grade because, ready for this? I doubt you remember it.
No, I doubt.
I'm going to make you look really bad.
No,
it was great. She writes middle grade, she told me, because you have all the intelligence and none of the hormones. So you have, there's this magic light that you're talking about, like you have the magic light at the end of the day or something like that, where there's this, yeah, you have this sweet spot of intelligence, sophistication, ability to process complex storylines,
humor,
characters, humor,
yeah.
Man, humor is exploding,
right.
And you're not yet in that just fully complicated social sphere that is going to pressure cook you.
Very and it narrows your world.
Yeah. And so the mistake that gets made is when people try to write to middle graders, like, they're not intelligent or they're not sophisticated
right.
on a plot level, on a character level, and it's really, you know, that's not the distinctive at all. YA is not more intelligent than middle grade frequently. It's has more ennui frequently, more angst, more social confusion, oftentimes, or different social confusion.
It generally takes place after spring break in sixth grade.
Yes.
You know, it's after that, it's YA.
Yeah. 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 Let's jump into that tween thing that you mentioned earlier. You can't spell tweed without tweed. Which means nothing. But I was speaking to a middle school teacher before we began all of this, and three out of four of you, I'd say, probably have been called middle school at some point. I doubt anyone has ever said, I could be wrong, but I don't know if many middle schools have done Penderwicks, but maybe they have. But middle schools are sort of that nebulous area because in public libraries, you don't have the middle school section, you have the kids section and the teen section. And the middle school is what gets completely messed up because we have to decide, is this teen, is this children's? Well, and you know, it's hell on us. So do you consider your books middle school as well as children's? Do you consider middle school a whole different beast? Where do you see middle school even falling in all of this?
I spend a lot of time in middle schools, going to middle schools, and I find that it breaks down by grade really clearly.
Yes.
So the eighth graders are already thinking of themselves as high schoolers, and I have to prove to them that they should listen to me, that there is any reason for them to be listening to a guy who writes kids' books. Okay. The sixth graders are thrilled. They cannot wait to meet an author, and I have, like, blood and stuff, and they're just so excited. They all like the blood, but the sixth graders, they're just thrilled. Mm-hmm. And the seventh graders just want to make snarky comments about my tie and my hair. Time. Some of them are excited, but most of them are rude. That's sort of how I see it breaking down.
You know, I've gone on tours. I had to learn very quickly to pay attention to what groups of kids I was going to be speaking to, because I've ended up in high schools. You're talking up to 12th grade, and then middle schools, and then down to third and fourth graders. And you can't talk to a group with all of them there.
Mm-hmm.
Not possible. Mm-hmm. But you break it out, then you just give different. You can get very good.
You just lie.
Well, it's actually like this. With the high schoolers or even the eighth graders, I all I need is bad boy credentials.
Yeah.
And it's sort of if I...
How do you get them?
I just tell them.
Sorry, Jenny.
So if I tell them very quickly about this, you know, brief moment in my life when I just was done with school and started throwing all my homework in the trash.
Mm.
After I just stopped doing it, and then my parents made me do it.
Or in the pond.
Yeah, so then I was like, okay, my parents made me do it, so I took it to school. They didn't tell me how to turn it in, so I was in the trash, you know, getting pulled off the roof of my school building, sneaking off during lunch and hosing down a friend at a car wash, you know, that kind of thing. It's like as soon as you, in like this time, you tell them about this moment, let me tell you about the time I tried to ruin my life. Like this 2-week period where, like, mm-hmm. I was, you know, I just went this direction. I don't tell them that happened in fifth grade. You know, it's like, that was all fifth grade, all of it, and all within, like, 2 weeks in fifth grade. So I tell them that, and then I started talking about, like, how that shifted for me, and they're all right there. If I try to tell third or fourth graders that, they are very nervous about me, and they're going to leave the room. So, but it's, you know, so, but if I tell the high schoolers since I did that in fifth grade, then it's like, you know, it doesn't work either. So it's different social access points, like where they're stressed out of how they're going to be seen, if they appreciate this, or, you know, are we blowing this guy off? You know, everybody? You know, that kind of thing. And if you make, sorry to this audience, if you make their teachers nervous, you have them. And then be over there.
John Chesky rule.
Yeah.
I wanted to say one thing about that, which is I have also found that the eighth graders are hungry for the life stuff, the life experience. The eighth graders always want to know, how many times were you rejected?
Yeah.
How many times did you fail, right?
Yeah.
Sixth graders, you know, maybe they'll ask if there's like an aspiring writer in there, but usually they want to know about the book and about the story.
Oh, they're dragons.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, yep, got it.
I ended up in high school once. I don't know how the hell that happened, but you know, all they wanted to know was how to get published.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, my God. And I said, yeah, you don't want to get published, you're only a kid, and all the other kids, no, he's really good, and it was a private school.
I actually offer to tell 7th grade and above how much I make when I'm getting them to ask me questions, because I know they desperately want to know it. And the 6th graders, when I occasionally offer it accidentally because I forget who I'm talking to, nobody takes me up on it. They don't care. 7th grade and up, immediately, it's like the second question that I ask. So,
that's interesting. Huh.
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting. Would you ever write straight YA yourself? There's nothing wrong with straight YA, I should mention. In the course of all this, YA is great if it's meant to be YA. Would you ever be interested in writing YA at all, or are you just fine with the middle grades?
Well, middle grade is my life at this point. I do have one love story. Where's Michelle? She knows it. About that has a teenager in it, but I don't know if I could write. I still don't even understand why YA is a category. It didn't exist when I was a child. So it might just be an adult book. But YA to me, I have to find this, and this is really rude to all the publishing people in it, but YA for me feels like a book published by, in its crassest sense, by a children's department in publishing that adults are willing to read. That's the only thing I can really grab onto. What makes YA? And maybe it's just because I've thought so much about what middle grade is and how important it is and how vital it is, and for us to be. Somebody talked about the intelligence levels. Was that you? And really to say, I know you're 10 and maybe you don't understand some of this stuff, but I'm going to throw my whole brain at you because I trust you to pick up the right stuff. And I have no idea where I started.
Your definition of YA just now is basically what they're now calling new adult.
And no doubt, does anybody else immediately think of Narcoholics Anonymous when they hear NA? Nobody? This is New York. I do NA. That's to me toast.
I do now.
Okay.
I think
NA, it's just crazy.
I would happily write something that people would then classify as YA. But I'm going to be writing the same stuff I'm writing.
Right.
So there would be some trigger, you know, my protagonist got old enough where now the market must brand it as YA or something like that. I mean, did Harry Potter become YA? No, it just became its own thing, its own genre completely. These really huge, massive tomes.
People find it very simple. If your protagonist is a teenager, they say, okay, then it's a YA book.
Yeah, so that kind of trigger, throwing that kind of switch, I could see that happening. Mm-hmm. But am I going to write some of the hypothetical YA plots that were thrown out.
We had a chain of emails where we were coming up with YA plots off the top of our head because...
I was the only one that did it.
No, I did it too. You read mine?
You changed mine.
I did.
You made it better. You made it more Nicholas Sparks. And I named it Heartwater. Heartwater. Come on. Heartwater. Yeah, sold. Heartwater from Nicholas Sparks.
We wrote it.
We did.
We sell it to him. He put his name.
Yeah. He does that.
I'll just ask one more, and then I think we'll take a couple questions from the audience. If you want to answer it, if you don't, that's fine too. What are you working on next?
P4.
A middle grade novel.
There you go.
Grimm 3, which is going to be called, I think, The Grimm Conclusion. So.
Nice.
Tasty.
So that's G3. I'm P4, you're
yeah.
G3.
Yeah.
Okay.
I am working on Ashdown Burial Rails 3 and called Empire of Bones, and then a standalone kind of magical realism adventure in the swamps.
It has muck.
The working title is Muck Flats.
It's got muck in
muck
it.
Muck Flats is the working, yeah.
I like that.
I can't wait.
Football and sugarcane and chasing rabbits.
Sign me up.
He knows how much I love his books, and yet, I have to find out from his blog that there are ARCs available, and then I have to
find out from my blog that ARCs are available.
and then I have to get it from the publicist. You never say genius another one.
I think you got your ARC before I did.
Oh, you're such a liar. Speaking of truth.
All right. Who wants to talk? Any questions?
Yes, you've talked about middle readers as though they are genderless, as though they are neuter. It's in the pre-sexual era, I get that. But could you, each one of you, say something about when you're writing for girls more or when you're writing for boys, that whole gender issue?
Well, I can try. Basically, and this... These are all the stereotypes in my own mind from my own experiences talking to readers. So, and I could be very wrong about this, but as I've gone out, I'm writing for that kid that I was in fifth grade who not only quit doing his homework, but quit reading other books. I just chucked all sorts of things and walked away. High reading level, you know, a lot of experience reading, and just was bored. Just was done with it and threw it away, and became what you would call some people would say a reluctant reader, but it wasn't an ability issue. It was just, I would rather go run in the wheat fields and climb in a barn. But what I've experienced is female readers are very, the ones who've read my books, are very versatile and very willing to go a lot of different directions, you know, in reading a story. And the boys are the ones who are staunchly prejudicial about, is this for me? Is this hopefully for someone who's of my gender and 1 or 2 years older than me, in which case I'm okay with it. If it's a protagonist 1 year younger than me, this is going to be a tough sell. Like, I have to be aspiring up. I have to be growing. So the only real thought I have is that I'm writing to the kind of thing I would have been excited by, and I was as much a problem reader as anybody could be at that phase. And part of that now, with the active engagement of video games, when I talk to young, older middle grade boys about my books, they want to let me know what their choices would have been and what their decisions would have been at particular moments. And so trying to consciously write in such a way that they have material with which to decide. So rather than having a character act and then retrospectively explain that action, like he did this because of this and because of that, giving them some information so they're moving towards a choice themselves, they're reading more actively, and then they can see the scales tip and then make a call. Like they make a decision and the character goes there, they're thrilled. It's like if they see the character do what they think the character should have done, even if it's crazy, you know, they draw that conclusion, they're quite pleased with themselves. So that's the real boy thing. For the girls, I haven't figured them out. I'm watching my daughters, you know, hit this age, and they'll read anything, and they'll enjoy anything. And it's not at all how I was, or how I can even see, you know, down to my younger son, how he is already far more staunchly prejudicial in his reading.
What Nate said that I completely agree with is that I write for myself for the second half of fifth grade. I write the kind of books that I wanted to read and loved. And so when I first started working on the Penwick series, which was the late 90s, there was a lot of talk about boys and getting boys to read. And there was so much talk about that I thought, well, you know, girls have to read too. And I was getting the sense that well, girls can read, so why should we write for them? So I thought, well, I want to write for myself, but I'm just going to write for girls. I'm just going to let it be for girls and not feel bad about them. So I'm always delighted when boys like the books. That's always special for me, but they're very clearly in a minority. And often the ones that do are ones who are in big families. So what they relate to are the relationships and the balance of power within the sets of children.
I'm one of those boys who likes your books.
Definitely. Thank you.
Yeah.
You're not 11.
My wife might disagree. I try to have a boy and a girl in all my books because I want as equal main characters, and I try to make sure that the girl is at least as badass as the boy, probably a little bit more. It tends to, you know, that way the kids feel like they have their entry point. And because my books are very bloody, I assume that the boys would be more into that than the girls. But I have found that it's not at all the case. The girls are just, when I go and talk about it at schools or whatever, and I very much talk about the blood, to try to get the reluctant readers in, right? I kind of trick them in through the gates and then hopefully do something interesting once they're already inside the book. And I find the girls are just as enthusiastic about the bloody, the terrifying stuff. They love horror. They love to come up to me and talk to me about all the terrifying, you know, movies they've seen and ask me if I've seen them. And I would say no, because I like scaring other people. I don't like being scared myself. So I try to get them both through that way. Yeah.
You're like Joss Whedon.
Touchdown.
I really don't think about it. I have to be, I mean, the honest answer is I do not think about it. And my main characters are evenly split. I have minor characters, you know, other gender.
Like each book has...
I don't know if this even is working, but... you know, each book is a mix. They definitely lean in one direction or the other. But it's just not one of the things I think about at all when I'm writing. And since it doesn't happen naturally, I haven't asked myself to pay attention to that at all.
I can take a question over here.
Hi, thanks. In the beginning, you distinguished between YA and middle school with this phrase, safe passage, by the narrator stepping in and providing safe passage to a younger group of kids, which isn't given to the YA kids because either they don't need it or they can be exposed to that level of story suspense. I was just curious, and I guess it's a process question, but how you guys think about when you're writing the stories, maintaining, if you worry or talk to your editors or talk to yourself about when you provide that safe passage, do you worry about the suspense that you're providing the reader? I don't mean suspense necessarily, like just terror. I just mean suspense is interest in the next scene, interest in what's being left unsaid.
Are you asking, is it difficult to protect, to balance safety and still have it have forward movement and suspense?
Yeah, I'm curious as a writer how you view that in your own work exactly, and maybe come up with a balance or whether you feel you're good at it or not, or maybe it's not something you think about, just your narrator comes out of you and it happens to be what it is. You know, how much do you think about that, I guess?
I think about it quite explicitly. I talk out loud to myself as I write, and I picture the kids in front of me that I have some sort of ideas, composites of kids that I've known, and I try to think about how they're reacting to it. And I think that so the narrator comes in whenever I feel like they need it, when I'm like, I'm going to ramp it up the tension as much as I can, and then I'm going to see how are they reacting, and then I'm going to pull in the narrator. And I actually think that I messed up in my second book recently. At the end of the first chapter, if you've read it, the frog loses his leg, and I say that chapter wasn't very bloody or upsetting. And I got a lot of emails right off the bat from kids being like, it's not okay to hurt animals. They were not okay. And the frog turns out great. And I like wrote them back and told them that. But they were so right. And I was just one moment where I felt like my sort of like balance just missed, just for a minute. Because it's almost like you're playing a game. You've got to watch the kids at all times. And in fact, the new printing of the book, I changed that narrative interjection to
wow.
take care of the kids better. And I just saw it come out, and it reads just much better. I'm much happier with it.
What does
the narrator do?
Yeah, so
at the end of the first chapter, in the first version at the end of the chapter, the narrator says, well, that wasn't very bloody. I know you want something even bloodier. And I know some of the boys were like, yeah, but a lot of the kids, not just boys, I mean, not just girls, boys too, were like, that was actually sad. That was upsetting. And so to acknowledge that, to be like that, and that's essentially what I say, that was really upsetting, but don't worry, the frog will not only be okay, he will be awesome. So I just take it, I missed a step.
Well, I...
Apology accepted.
Yeah, you know...
I was one of those boys, right?
No, you know, actually, I'm one of those people that absolutely cannot stand to have animals harmed, and there's a scene in Maniac McGee, and that I still can't talk about, but there was, I felt because you had said that nothing bad had happened, I knew you were taking care of the frog. I mean, that's, you did, and I think it's wonderful that you're, but if that had, you were saying that, I thought, what at the end of the chapter? Because if it had been that bad, and I'm hypersensitive to this stuff, I would have then stopped reading.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have talked to you. Seriously. So, but I love it that you're, I think it's great that you're that sensitive to it.
And just something very similar in answer is, if I feel like I'm pressure cooking things, like things are dialing up, I'm looking for a moment where there can be a point of rest,
yeah.
Like regroup. And I also, out of early conversation with Jeannie here, frequently food. Yeah, so a moment of like regroup
eat.
And some sort of you know, some sort of sustenance, some kind of peace offering, like something is given and there's a moment like, okay, like, you know, here we go. So frequently, as things get really, really bad, my characters get hungry and you know, end up in a kitchen late at night for exactly that kind of moment. Or I'll turn a different direction if something, at this point in the book, I've had a lot of ugly surprises, so they're expecting something really bad, and then it turns out to actually be one upbeat surprise. And you try to walk that line and balance things. And hopefully your editors and early readers will catch things where you mess up beforehand.
But also, Rebecca, yesterday you were talking about the emotion that you, for any action to happen, you have to feel the emotion of the protagonist and each different. And I think that's part of finding the balance. If you are that in tune with your characters emotionally, then you're going to know that they're terrified, that you've gone over the edge somehow. And I think that's another way to keep it honest and emotionally and not too scary. Because you've never freaked me out either, which is kind of unbelievable, the places you go.
Yeah, I don't know. It's been interesting, actually, listening to you guys talk. My books are pretty quiet, really.
They simmer.
So I guess I'm always thinking, I never worry about, you know, that my pacing is too intense. and so I think what I do, I mean, I think it is more of, you know, a challenge in a way. I'm trying to hook the reader kind of to the emotion of my character and then sort of pull them along. And then there are moments, I do think pretty kind of concretely about when the emotion surfaces. So I do think that I try to have the emotion kind of running underground, meaning that it's not a secret, and hopefully my reader is experiencing it or relating to it, you know, with his or her own experience. But then I try to sometimes create some kind of power or, you know, like sort of a high point by having the emotion surface, you know, because I think that a lot of the time we're experiencing emotions, I mean, now in adolescence, as a kid, forever, for me, you know, and then there are moments when you recognize your own emotion, and those can be powerful moments, and so I think much more along those lines. If I could have, like, incredibly intense action, you know, I don't know how to do that, so I don't have that problem at all.
Well, I know that we all here would just love to just sit here for a couple hours at a time and just make you guys talk as long as we possibly could. But that was actually a pretty good note to end on, and we have run out of time. So I would like to, first and foremost, I would like to thank Adrian Weintraub and Random House for bringing many of our authors to us here today. And I would like to thank our four fantastic panelists for joining us and having such a great conversation. Thank you all for coming. We'll see you next time.